Here's how I can increase my sense of safety. Here's actions I can take. Here's things that are out of my control that I'm choosing to accept or turn over to God or to allow to be there. And we define that. Then we can work through and make that a more adaptive belief, a less rigid and dramatic black and white belief. When I trust in this or when I'm surrounded by that, I have moments of safety. We have to be careful not to label ourselves as broken.
Welcome to The Lisa Show, where we take a good look at life. Hey, it's Lisa. Welcome to The Lisa Show. I want to give you a little context for why I'm talking about this topic, since The Lisa Show isn't a news podcast. In the last year, there have been a few horrible acts of violence in my community. In Grand Blanc Township, Michigan, members of my faith were targeted by a mass shooter and arsonist at church. A few weeks before that, there was a shooting at the university a few miles away from where I live and work. And I know that I'm not alone. If anything, it's becoming a universal experience to find out that the people you love, people you know, or people you share neighborhoods with have been the victims of violence. But speaking as a person who has experienced a certain amount of tragedy firsthand, I found myself taken aback by how different it feels to cope with this kind of heartache. So that's where I started when beginning this episode. When my team and I arrived to work in that surreal way that you do after something shocking and tragic happens, and somehow there's no time to think about it and you still have to send emails, we decided that somebody out there must know how to live with and manage and heal this strange and relentless kind of secondhand community trauma. And fortunately, we did find that someone. Her name is Emma McAdam. This really isn't a heavy episode. Emma talks about metabolizing pain and fear in ways that protect our mental health and help you to sustainably heal. You've probably heard me reference the 24/7 news cycle in a few episodes recently. It's been on my mind. If you feel trapped between wanting to stay responsibly informed and the wear and tear on your well-being to do that, Emma has the most brilliant answer. Overall, this conversation will restore your hope that no matter what cruelty or chaos happens, you will be able to find healing and meaning and joy again. Emma is not only a licensed therapist, but she's also an educator who saw a need for accessible information about mental health back in 2017 and started building a YouTube channel, Therapy in a Nutshell, to provide bite-sized information about coping skills, mindset, and self-care to people who needed it. And she never expected to get where she is today, with millions of subscribers and a platform that has done a lot of good over time. But part of that story included being in the right place at the right time accidentally.
I'm Emma McAdam. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and we make mental health skills more accessible. We take the education side of therapy, condense it down into a careful video that teaches people how to get better at feeling.
Get better at feeling.
At feeling.
What a great job.
It's so cool.
I didn't even know that could be a job, you know?
Yeah.
Because
neither did I. I have no idea how this happened.
We'll heal the world. You will.
Oh, I don't know. But a little bit, I think we all contribute in our sphere. So somehow I ended up on YouTube.
I love how you say somehow I ended up on.
Yeah.
What happened?
I was an art major who became a recreation therapy major who just wanted to work outside. So I was like, I'll become a therapist to be able to work in wilderness therapy. So I became a therapist, never ended up working in wilderness therapy, worked in a bunch of other settings, juvenile corrections, residential treatment centers, outpatient therapy. And then I had kids and I wasn't working as much. And I just saw like so many people needed mental health support, so many people struggling with depression, anxiety. And I was like, oh, I have these ideas for you. Did you know about this skill? Did you know that like morning sunlight exposure or light therapy is as effective as SSRIs for mild to moderate depression? Like most people had no idea. And I was like, I want to tell people about this. So I had little kids at this point, and I was like at 5 a.m. I'd get up and write a script and work on it. And for 3 years, I made videos and nothing really happened. In 2019, I made $19 off of my YouTube channel.
That sounds like the residuals that actors get.
Yeah.
You know, for 42 cents for a commercial you did like 10 years ago. That's fun.
Exactly. Yep. And so in 2019, I had my third kid and I no longer had nap time. I no longer had like mornings because three kids, like their sleep schedules never aligned.
Different phases of life.
Yeah. Yeah. I was working on the channel still on Saturdays. I was like, this is kind of disruptive for our family. Like, we don't have a lot of space to do this. And I felt like it was time to quit. I was like, time to be done with this fun little side hustle or whatever it was. And
I tried.
Yeah, I tried. Put in good effort. I prayed about it. Felt like really strongly I needed to go just one more month. And this was in January of 2020. And in February of 2020, two of my videos went viral and got a million views. This is COVID's coming in, like everything was
right
crazy.
On the heels of it.
Yeah, so I just feel very called to this work. I feel very much like there's so many people who can't access therapy, can't access mental health support, and
need it.
And need it.
Not want it, but need it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you for being so willing to help our audience here too. I wanted to talk to you, especially, well, you know, we used to say at this time with this particular tragedy, upon recording this interview, we're talking about the events in Michigan most recently.
Yeah.
I'm sure when the podcast comes out, unfortunately, I'm pretty confident that there'll be another event or string of events that we're referring to.
Right.
The event of the trauma doesn't matter as much. And again, as a woman of a certain age, I can't believe I'm saying this because this isn't the way that I talked when I was in my teens or early 20s, that of these kinds of attacks, just particular violence and specifically news events and violence in communities that affect the people that you love.
Right. Oh, I think it hits all of our hearts at some point. And I think it's sometimes easy. Like for me, I would just think, oh, statistically, it's unlikely that this is going to like affect me. Like I see stories of school shootings. I see, and it's like, I have to kind of like distance myself a little bit from this because it's so painful. But then we have more events. And at some point, we're all affected, both through like what we see and caring for the people who we watch on the news. And also, like at this point, most of us know someone.
Yeah.
Who's been there.
We have a story.
Yeah. I was out in Boston last week and I was sitting across the table from someone. I was talking about, oh, you know, I'm from Provo. Where's that? Oh, it's right by Orem. Oh, we've all heard of Orem.
Now we know.
Now we all know where Orem is. And then we just got talking. It's like, how many of us have been impacted by an act of violence? And everyone at the table was like, oh yeah, like my mom lives a block down from where the Boston Marathon bomber was, you know, found in a boat. And everyone at the table was like, yeah. This nearly impacted me. This impacted me in this way. So I think we're all being impacted not only by these acts of violence, but also by watching it and reading it and hearing about it. It impacts us.
And we do live in a 24/7 news cycle, which again, a generation ago or so wouldn't have existed as well.
That's right. And I think this is really important. When we talk about how do we respond to trauma, we have to understand that the perception of danger is just as real to our brains and our body's physiological response as being in the presence of real danger. So when we worry, when we think about danger, when we consume it, when we watch it, our body has the same physiological response. But what's different is 100 years ago, when you heard about your neighbor's house burning down, you would run over there and you would mobilize and you'd activate and you'd go help them and you'd do something about it. And all of those stress chemicals that were surging through your body would get burned off by doing something about it. And now, when we hear about something on the news, most of the time, those stress chemicals still come up, the cortisol, the adrenaline come up, and then we don't have anywhere for them to go.
We feel like our efforts don't matter.
That's right. We feel a little bit helpless or powerless. And our body responds to that by like numbing a lot of times or going into a stress response that gets stuck. So people respond to that by getting stuck in chronic stress or then going to a place of numbing or hopelessness. And that's something we really have to learn how to manage. Like we have to learn how to use our nervous system because most of us have never been taught.
Okay, so
oh, so here we
agreed.
Are. Yeah.
And I appreciate you taking the time to explain it. And you talked a little bit about like what you have to say to yourself or how you think about it. Okay, I am not in danger. Everything's right. Okay. How do you think about it?
I think it's important to back up just a little bit and think about our consumption and say, we have to honestly admit that when we consume news, we are putting stress on our body and our nervous system. And I think there's different ways to think about how we consume news and how we consume this information. But I would just say, can we be a little bit intentional when we consume media? And that means maybe limit when we consume media. If we consume it first thing in the morning or last thing at night, then we have less chance to process it throughout the day. Or if we're constantly consuming it in small doses, chronic stress impacts us very differently than acute stress. So a short stressful event, we can handle, we can manage, we can deal with it. Our nervous system activates, and then we calm down and our nervous system responds with a parasympathetic response, and we can restore our sense of safety. So like we're actually very good at handling stress. Our bodies are actually very resilient. But when we're consuming stress in a chronic way, when we're experiencing stress in tiny doses throughout the day, our body and our nervous system becomes a little bit less resilient to that.
That is new information to me.
Really?
Well, yes, because I think in my mind, if I just sort of check the news every once in a while, then it will be different if I'm like going down in a deep dive to it.
Yeah.
But if I am being really honest, like when I was in a time of great stress and there were always events that I was constantly responding to, my cortisol levels just absolutely, my body was like, oh, wait, we can't function like this anymore.
Yeah.
So I should know this information, but it is something that's hard. So here's my pushback. My pushback is I want to be informed about the world and what's going on.
Yeah. And so I think,
and I know lots of people who are like, well, then I never watch the news. I don't know what's going on. And I just think, well, that's not good. I'm critical of that.
Here's how I think about this is, can we consume news and information in an intentional way? So we decide why we're using the news, why we're using media, and we choose to do it in an actionable way. So if we say, hey, I'm going to read the news twice a day for 20 minutes, and then after that, I'm going to give myself a minute to process what I've experienced or think about how can I act on that? Like, what if when we consumed news, we thought about this, like, I'm going to consume as much news or information as is actionable. I want to be informed so that I know who to vote for. I want to be informed so that I know how to keep my family safe. I want to be informed so that I can take action on this. And that's the difference between consuming news as like entertainment.
You're right.
Or, and entertainment's okay, but we just need to be intentional about it.
Right.
Or consuming news in an actionable way. And when we are able to take news and information and sort it into kind of two categories, stuff I can't do anything about and stuff I can do something about, then we choose, like, I'm going to take a small action in line with this. Our nervous system actually is very happy about that. Right? So you hear your neighbor's house is burning down. It's not like you don't want to hear that story. You want to know about it so you can take action. So if it's like, oh, I want to hear about what's going on in my society so that I can actually take some action. I think a lot of us feel very helpless, but in small ways, we can take more action than we realize.
If you want to be able to act on the information you learn, you have to start with that purpose in mind. Otherwise, you and your nervous system will be overloaded. This stopped me in my tracks. First of all, because it's preventative. Building emotional resilience starts before the bad things have even happened. And second, because the opposite is also true, mindlessly consuming news can actually undermine your emotional resilience. Bombarding yourself with as much information as the algorithm throws at you is not the same as being informed. You'll burn out, you'll feel paralyzed, and you'll be less effective as a person trying to make the world a better place. Remember when Facebook was for sharing your life? It's not like that anymore. The second you open it, it is serving you content and news and opinions and noise that you didn't choose. It's unintentional by default. And the line between information and entertainment gets blurrier by the day. That comes with very personal consequences. I would guess that for most of us, making our news consumption intentional would involve making some major changes to screen time. It's not all or nothing on consuming news. We need to be informed, but we need to do it in a way that protects our ability to act on the information we consume. That actually makes us better community builders. Passive consumption drains your mental well-being. Being able to take action boosts it. As long as we're talking about social media, Emma has another point about the long-term consequences of the way we respond, and specifically the way we talk about traumatic events.
We have to recognize that when we hear a news story, or we hear about trauma, or we hear about a political story that bothers us, we're going to have an emotional reaction. And when we have an emotional reaction, the part of our brain that thinks really clearly turns off. Mm-hmm. And the part of our brain that's like reactive or more black and white thinking, mm-hmm. or more likely to label other people as the bad guys, is going to turn on. Now, this is not like our brains being bad to us. This is a survival mechanism. If I was like 1,000 years ago living in a little village and a tribe is coming to attack my village, I'm not going to be thinking about this in a nuanced way. I'm not going to be like, yeah. oh, these people were once little children who their yeah. mothers loved.
They
I wonder.
Were babies and their mothers cradled them in their arms.
Right.
They're yeah. just hungry. They just have basic yeah. needs. Like, yeah, you don't think that.
You don't. You have a strong emotional yeah. reaction. You get defensive. You get your weapons. You like defend. You run away. You fight yeah. them off. And you think about them in a black and white sort of way. You think about, these are the bad guys. These are the threats. We're the good guys. We got to save our family. You're going to notice everything threatening and dangerous and bad about them and everything good and safe and right about you. And you're going to sing songs about your people and your war cries. And so this is like our brain has a defensive mechanism to think about others in extreme ways, to label events as like worse than ever, and to do black and white thinking. Everything's worse today than it was before. And we have to just be aware that when we hear news, that that's what's being elicited. And the modern news algorithm favors more emotionally evocative stories. So you have to be...
Remember that in yeah. how you talk about mm-hmm. events.
Yeah. When Charlie Kirk was shot, I knew that if I made an emotionally reactive video in response to that, that I would make money. That I would get more views, I would get more subscribers.
You're so
I would
right. get, oh, yeah. yeah.
I would get more reactions, I would get more drama in the comments. And that if a video gets all of those engagements, it performs better on YouTube. I also knew that I was emotionally reactive after that, right? A lot of people in my neighborhood were impacted by that. I felt it very close to home. I also had a video scheduled to publish that day that mentioned politics. It was not a political
really?
Video.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, mentioned politics.
So what did you do?
So this video was a meditation about disturbances. It was like, hey, here's an exercise for when you feel disturbed. Go ahead and think of someone who makes you feel upset. And then let's work through this.
Wow.
The person I happened to choose for this exercise happened to be a political figure. I did not mention their name, but I knew that some people would be able to guess. Yeah. We could all probably guess someone emotionally reactive in our political sphere right now. And I thought, you know, my initial reaction was to not publish that video, to maybe make a reaction video, to maybe mm-hmm. talk about how we sure. should respond to this. And yeah. I'm not saying any of those were bad options. But in the end, I decided, after sleeping on it, after taking it slow, to not change anything and to move forward, to shift my focus back away from my emotions to my mission, like what I was moving toward. And for those who can't see like what I'm doing with my hands, like I have to do this in almost a physical way. When we're emotionally reactive, we have to choose to like center and calm ourselves and then shift our attention back to like what's most important in my life. What am I working on? What am I doing? Whether it's our small spheres of our family and our homes, our coworkers, or a much bigger sphere of like, I want to share this on social media. Like, I think we just have to constantly redirect to like, what's most important? What am I working toward? Who am I trying to be right now? Choosing just to redirect our energy to like loving our kids, being kind to our siblings, calling up our parents, mowing our lawn, cleaning up a piece of litter. Like, that doesn't feel that big. But if each person tries to do good in their sphere in response to the pain and suffering they see, it makes the world better. And I think we have to acknowledge, like, that is making a difference.
Let's acknowledge that that does make a difference. And let's start talking more about how that is everything.
Yeah. I mean, and it's so easy to look at, let's say, the Charlie Kirk situation, and everyone says, everyone needs to be more civil. Everyone needs to be, like, value free speech. And how many of us are willing to say, hey, what can I do today? Like, am I being reactive? Am I contributing to this by what I consume or how I respond to what I consume? Am I perhaps thinking that my group of people is really loving and the other group of people is not loving. That's a common cognitive bias. Most of us don't realize it. Attribution bias. We assume that everyone else is getting distorted by social media or what they're reading, but not me. And so I think as we look at these painful political situations, we can create more healing by truly slowing ourselves down, not reacting to our emotions. We can value those and honor those. And we can talk more about like when we're traumatized. Sure. We can talk more about that. But we have to acknowledge like our brain is not going to be functioning in a clear and honest way when we're highly emotional. We have to value those emotions, but then choose actions based on our values.
Something I love about what Emma shared here is that it gives us room to be gentle to our brains, which have the tendency to get tribal and look for an enemy when we feel hurt. That black and white, no middle ground, us or them thinking is such a human thing, and we all do it. Knowing that can help all of us recognize that this is a response to pain, and honestly, that does give me comfort. When you feel like things are worse than they have ever been, and that people around you are against you, that's not necessarily the case, but it is a very normal response to this kind of stress. We can all take a breath, feel our feelings, and make choices based on our values when we're ready. I also don't want to gloss over the profound simplicity of redirecting our energy, like Emma said. When you're feeling acute stress, it's more important than ever to find a way to give and serve. It can be small. You may not be able to directly address the source of what has disturbed you. But rather than measuring your efforts by whether it feels enough, consider that small acts of kindness, outreach, and love are also a powerful way to regulate your nervous system. At this point, it was time for me to ask Emma about the big capital T trauma. Is that even the right word for what we're talking about? At the time I had the conversation with Emma, there had been another incident at one of my local schools where a child died a violent way in front of their peers. What do we do when we or people we love feel broken by what they have experienced or witnessed?
I recently saw a news article as well that was about an event that was traumatic at a school. And what the reporter said was, now all these kids are traumatized. And I thought, I want to be careful about how we use this term. First, we have to talk about this implicit understanding. We have this understanding in our culture that if you have a mental health diagnosis, that it's permanent. Like, so if you get diagnosed with depression, that's a permanent character state that you have. And that's not how diagnoses work. Mental health diagnoses are different from physical diagnoses in that it's when you have these symptoms, then you meet the criteria for depression. And when you don't have 5 out of the 9 of these symptoms, you no longer meet the criteria for depression. So I personally believe that many mental health conditions, if not the majority of them, are treated gone when the symptoms are gone. They don't have to be a permanent characteristic. Mm. This is not a permanent part of you. This may not be the case with certain more chronic severe mental illnesses like schizophrenia, but with depression and anxiety and PTSD, I 100% believe these are treatable conditions. So when we talk about trauma, people are relating this to PTSD, which is a diagnosis.
Yes.
So PTSD is a diagnosis. You have to meet a certain number of criteria after a traumatic event. This is when your response to stress is getting stuck and it hasn't resolved after 4 weeks. That's an unfair amount of time to label it, but that's what PTSD is. It has to be 4 weeks after the event. And you have to have a certain amount of symptoms, and then you check the box for PTSD. And so when people use the word trauma is a much broader term than PTSD. So just like how ADHD used to refer to 5% of the population, and now it's being used in a much more broad way to refer to 30 or 40% of the population, trauma is being used in a similar way.
Oh.
So PTSD, and I'm not saying it's not real. I'm saying if we use the word trauma and then people think that it's a permanent characteristic, that's where people feel more helpless, more stuck, less empowered. They feel like, oh, my kid was at this event. Now they're traumatized. They might think this is a permanent like injury that will never heal.
Right.
And I think we just have to be careful how we use that. My definition of trauma is when your nervous system is overwhelmed or when a situation is overwhelming and you don't know what to do with it. And then we see symptoms, right? We see physical symptoms. We see people being stuck in a stress response. We see people being stuck in a depressive response. We see beliefs change.
Pausing just for a moment here, I want to highlight the importance of what Emma just said. Trauma is real, like PTSD is real. But the idea that it's untreatable or a permanent condition, that is a misconception. Our nervous systems were designed to heal. Ironically, the system of trauma that Emma's describing now, prolonged stress responses, depressive or anxiety responses, these are a part of the way that our brains are trying to heal and protect us. But there's more that we can do, and it comes back to the beliefs that Emma mentioned.
So someone's belief about safety might change. Now I'd never feel safe again. Or their belief about other people might change. Oh, I can't trust anyone again. Or all fill in the blank are bad people, right? Like all men are bad, or all Republicans are bad, or all Democrats are bad, whatever. So our beliefs change. And if we think about trauma as a way our body is trying to protect us by responding to a situation, then we can learn new ways to respond that are more adaptive. So these kids who are at this traumatic event, someone died at their school, right? What if we use more nuanced words? What if we say, was that scary for you? Now what do we do with fear? How do we restore your sense of safety? Was that sad for you? How do we work through sadness? How do we honor sadness? How do we use grief as a beautiful experience, right? Did that change how you think about the world? You thought school was safe, and now you don't think school is safe. Okay, your belief system was impacted. This is a much more specific way of thinking about it than saying you were traumatized, so you probably need therapy for 10 years. Instead, we say, well, how is your belief system impacted? I no longer feel safe, or I worry all the time about like what might happen. Okay, how do we work with those thoughts? And sometimes trauma does change your beliefs about the world forever.
Yeah.
Right? Like it does. How do we make that adaptive? How do we make that healthy? So if my trauma response is now I'm never safe again, that's a very black and white, very broad term. Okay, what if we make this more nuanced and more specific and we say now I don't feel safe when ... Here's how I can increase my sense of safety. Here's actions I can take. Here's things that are out of my control that I'm choosing to accept or turn over to God or to allow to be there. And we define that. Then we can work through and make that a more adaptive belief, a less rigid and dramatic black and white belief. But like, I'm never safe again.
Yeah.
Is now like, I feel a degree of safety when I do this. I feel safe in my body when I do this. When I trust in this, or when I'm surrounded by that, I have moments of safety. So I would just say we have to be careful not to label ourselves as broken. That's really what matters.
Yeah.
We can call it trauma, but don't think it's permanent. Don't believe this stuff is like a permanent damaging that happened to you.
The first belief to dismantle is that you or someone you love is broken. Then you can look closer at how beliefs about the world, about life, and about people may have changed unconsciously. Do you feel safe? Are there things you can do to feel safer? And is there anything you used to believe which made you feel safe before, which is still true? It's so interesting to me to have this conversation about beliefs because I don't typically think of the software in my brain as being overwritten all the time. I know what I believe. But thinking back, I can see how this little trick of neuroscience, this overriding beliefs, works. When bad things have happened in my life, it did change my sense of safety and calm and hope at the time. These weren't conscious decisions to change what I believed. I just felt different, worse. And over time, reinforcing what I choose to believe, that God really is loving, and there's a bigger picture, and that having hope is justified, that has helped me return to a place where I can feel safer again. Emma isn't prescribing what you should believe here, just pointing out that one of the lingering symptoms of trauma is an unintentional change in beliefs. Knowing that gives you a choice where you didn't have one before. Processing like this can feel like hard work, but Emma also told me it gets easier. Life may not get easier, and pain doesn't become less painful, but choosing to feel and process our own feelings so that we can heal is a skill.
Every experience is a chance to get better at feeling. Like we just increase our capacity to feel things. and to process them and to work through them.
Do you know, I used to think of myself, I was called a very sensitive child. You're being too sensitive. Mm-hmm. You're overly, why are you
Me
so
too.
Sensitive? And in my 20s, I just thought, I gotta not, this is a liability. I gotta stop being.
I gotta figure out how to not feel this.
Yes.
Me too.
I gotta toughen up a little bit.
Yeah.
And then I realized later, especially as I gained a lot of life experience with other humans in lots of different kinds of relationships, well, this is my superpower. I've got to stop trying to stuff this down or apologize for it, but I do need to learn how to think about it differently.
Yeah.
And not be so scared of it, because some of those big feelings are so like, oh, I can't do this on a Wednesday. I can't feel this intense. I got stuff to do. Like, this is going to knock me out. But the older I get, and just life has beaten it out of me, honestly. Because you know how, I don't know, I've had to learn the same lesson over and over again. Oh, being curious. This feeling's coming up. Oh, I didn't know you were coming today.
Hello.
This seems very, I wasn't actually really expecting you. This is just an ordinary Tuesday. Why are you here? Okay, why do I feel this way? And I know where I feel it in my body. And and I just sit and talk at it and then go do something else and then move on. But I used to just think, I'll deal with that later. Like maybe next Saturday, I'll pencil it in to feel those big.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's beautiful. I think it shows like how beautiful every experience we have is like, oh, here's a chance to practice with an emotion. Or every interaction we have with a human, it's like, oh, that person drives me crazy. This is an interesting opportunity to learn about myself. And like, yeah, being sensitive is such a beautiful thing that we have to figure out like how to work with it, like how to like
live in the world.
Yeah, feel it and
function
too. Because
it does make people uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Which maybe isn't the worst thing.
For those of you who are just listening, both Lisa and I have cried multiple times in this session.
We've already teared up. But here's the difference. I remember telling myself when I got this job 7 years ago at a very intense, traumatic time of my life, no crying at work.
Yeah.
No crying at work.
Not allowed.
I was afraid of looking unprofessional, looking out of control, looking vulnerable, looking embarrassing. I thought, oh, my situation, my life situation is such a mess and so embarrassing. I don't want anyone to make a comment on it. I don't want people to know what I'm thinking. I want to maintain a certain just distance because I can't feel all the things everywhere.
Right.
I'm going to keep this place separate. And I have since learned that we're human beings and that we're meant to feel lots of different things, and it's not the worst thing in the world. And in fact, it's an invitation for others to feel their feelings and to be who they really are and to show up. And that vulnerability is very powerful.
We can't just tell people it's okay to be sad.
It's okay to feel your feelings. It's okay.
Okay
to be sad.
It's
and
okay
then
to
not
have a
be
bad
sad
day.
Ever or not react to something.
Right. As I hear you talk, I think about myself too, like, especially my 20s, have to be positive, have to like control my emotions. If I change how I think, I can fix how I feel.
Yeah.
And
oh my gosh, it's like we have the same brain.
Yeah. And then if I felt like crying, I would clench and crunch my face up and not let it happen. And I'd get a headache and it would stick with me and I'd feel sad and heavy for like a week.
Yeah.
And now when I feel like crying, I let myself feel emotional and I tear up. I feel it. I say, hello, how long are you going to be here visiting me today, sadness? And usually, sometimes sadness hangs out for a while.
Yeah.
But usually it's like, oh, cool. At least you acknowledge me. Just wanted to say hi. Okay. See you later. And it rolls through you. Like it metabolizes, it rolls through you. You don't have to carry it for so long. And this is what I mean by like getting better at feeling. If each of us, each time we see something traumatic or scary on the news, or we feel upset or disturbed, if we take it back to ourselves and we manage to regulate ourselves and work through it, we fuel these cycles of peace, these cycles of healing, really. Like it is the most important work. It's not like to change the world, we need to all get out on social media and yell at everyone else. The healing work happens when we get better at sitting with our feelings. And then we share that calming, peaceful energy with the people around us and activated energy. We go out and do something about it. We take little actions to make our home a little bit kinder, our workplace a little bit kinder. Or when our coworker brings up something dramatic on politics, we respond to it in like a responsive, safe way. We heal the world.
Healing the world starts with healing ourselves. This is a situation where you have to put your oxygen mask on first before being able to help others.
because emotionally resilient people can do more good. In a 24/7 news cycle world, it's tempting to consume news as entertainment and to get swept up in the divisive noise that always comes with it. But if we can have the discipline to resist news entertainment and instead consume information intentionally for the purpose of acting on it, we can channel our natural curiosity and stress into action, which makes our communities better and regulates our nervous systems. And in those moments, when we do get overwhelmed, when the pain or the fear or the weight of tragedy feels suffocating, we can take the time to feel, to process, and to take new inventory of our beliefs. Trauma, in some ways, is inevitable. No one gets a free pass, but it is also treatable. The hope that you have, that you used to have, or that you want to have, that everything can get better, it's true. We were always designed to heal.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, hosted by Lisa Valentine Clark. This episode was produced by Becca Hurley-Lung, with help from Erica Price, Blake Morse, and Kenny Mears, with post-production by Gracie Davis. A special thanks to today's guest, Emma McAdam. A link to her YouTube channel will be in the show notes. Don't miss out on two other amazing podcasts from the Lisa Show family, The Council of Moms and Proofread, a new book review podcast to help you read more of what you love. You can find The Council of Moms and Proofread on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. As always, thanks for your messages. We read them all. And thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Lisa from The Lisa Show. And if you want to hear another great show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts, check out Constant Wonder. Host Marcus Smith takes you on an exhilarating journey through captivating stories of our magnificent natural world. You'll gain profound insight into different facets of our planet. Prepare to discover more about nature and perhaps even ponder your connection to Earth's wonder. Constant Wonder. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.